You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you've probably been hearing a lot about PFAS chemicals, but what exactly are they? We'll break down the basic science and talk about the health and environmental risks associated with them. First, the franchise owner of multiple chain restaurants here in Wisconsin was fined by the U.S. Department of Labor last week for violating child labor laws. Mana Inc. allegedly committed violations at 40 separate Wendy's and Fazoli's restaurants across the state. In a press release last Friday, the Department of Labor announced the company would pay close to $160,000 for those violations, as well as violations in eight other states. Paul Secunda is a professor of law at Marquette University, an expert on labor and employment law. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
How often do we see these kind of child labor violations actually go to the stage where people are getting fined for them?
You know, not often. I would say the various sections of what's called the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's three. So you have minimum wage, you have overtime, and then you have child labor. I would say child labor is the most forgotten. You know, obviously many teens from the ages of 13 to 16 are working in various jobs throughout the state and throughout the country, and yet it's always interesting when you hear one of these cases actually be settled because it just doesn't happen all the time.
And we're talking in this case, I think, mostly about teens in the 14 and 15 age range. What kind of laws are there specifically for them and how much and when they can work?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the federal and state laws here are pretty similar. So it's under the federal Fair Labor Standards Act, but Wisconsin also, through its Department of Workforce Development, has rules as well. So what we're talking about here are rules that say that minors under 16 years of age may work no more than 3 hours per day on school days and no more than 8 hours per day on non-school days. Also, they may work no more than 18 hours per calendar week in weeks when school is in session and 40 hours per calendar week when school is not in session. So this is very specific based on school days versus non-school days, summer versus the school year. And here, what the company agreed to settle over were requirements where 14 and 15-year-olds, as you said, were allowed to work more than the 3 hours that are allowed under law, and also the hours. Apparently, in some of these cases, they were working before 7 a.m. in the morning, which is not permitted, and after 7 p.m. on school nights, which is not permitted.
What does enforcement look like of these kind of laws? Because it seems like if this is happening, one 15-year-old at one restaurant, these rules are being violated. It seems like that's probably not going to make it to the Department of Labor.
No, what the Department of Labor, their wage and hour division is looking for is symbolic cases. In other words, cases like this one where you had something like over or almost 450 minors who are involved in this large restaurant change. So what they're trying to do is they prefer voluntary compliance. They just hope that people who employ children this age will voluntarily follow the law, but every so often, a complaint will be raised by an employee. They do have inspectors that do surprise audits of various types of restaurants and other types of industries where children tend to be overworked or otherwise in violation of child labor laws. So there's only so many inspectors to go around in Wisconsin and the federal government. So the resources they have to use strategically.
Talking to Paul Secunda, professor of law at Marquette University, focusing on labor and employment law, talking about a case, a franchise owner of a bunch of restaurants in Wisconsin and elsewhere fined by the U.S. Department of Labor for violating child labor laws. Now, we're talking about $160,000 here, Paul. If I own one franchise, that's a lot of money. This company owns a lot of franchises in multiple states. Is this, I think some people have described this as a slap on the wrist. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's not a lot of money, given how many restaurants are involved. And as you pointed out, 40 are located in Wisconsin. But, of course, there are many more than that in the other eight states. I think, again, it's symbolic. I think it's trying to say, look, right now we are at this level. If you keep doing it, we can actually raise the fines. The way that fines work under this law is if they're repeated or if they're willful, they can be increased. That is, the amount of the fine per child who's involved in the unlawful work. So, you know, this company is now on notice that if they continue to engage in these practices, it won't be $160,000 next time. It will be substantially larger. And obviously, in-house legal counsel for this company is not going to take that risk. So they're trying to, again, use what resources they have to send a message to this company that this type of practice will not be tolerated because it's putting children at risk, but also telling others who are both in the fast food industry but other industries that use a lot of children that they should be on notice as well, that these types of fines will be forthcoming.
Paul, can you give us a sense of some of the history behind how these child labor laws came to be in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually very interesting because it started in 1938 when we were in a depression in this country. And a few years after its enactment, the Supreme Court of the United States kind of broke it down as far as what is the purpose of the child labor protections. And there's two purposes. First, they said it should be recalled that the child labor provisions of the law and its purposes were both economical and sociological. So the entire nation had been affected with the depression that was worldwide. It was desirable to protect adult employees against the competition of minors. Moreover, Congress was afforded an opportunity by reason of prevailing conditions to act a law long agitated for and exceedingly desirable to protect children against harmful labor. So not only does it protect adults from competition from children who make less money, but it also goes hand in hand with compulsory education laws. The idea is to get kids out of the workplace, into school, so they have educational opportunities, so the types of employment they have going forward allow them to make a better standard of living.
And looking back, we may have seen the historical pictures of the kids in the coal mines or other places that, you know, now we really think kids shouldn't be. Has that kind of extreme, maybe even dangerous environment for kids been pretty much fixed in this country?
I would say no, and it makes me sad to say that. There are still children throughout this country, especially in unmonitored factories and in many large cities, who are immigrant children, who are not documented, who are working in what can only be called either sweatshop conditions. Also in the agricultural world, we still have a lot of children who are picking fruit, harvesting vegetables. It is an ongoing problem, and one of the things I want to say to those who are listening is that even though there's not a lot of litigation involving child labor, it's a substantial problem in the United States, and it's an even bigger problem worldwide. The poorer the countries, the more likely you're going to see children doing extremely dangerous work. It might not be a coal mine, but it might be operating dangerous machinery or being exposed to dangerous chemicals. We want children out of danger in those workplaces and in the classroom where they belong so they can be educated and avoid some of these hazards in the workplace.
How do you tackle that problem here in the United States? If we're talking about kids who don't have documentation, their parents aren't going to want to come forward and report this for fear of leaving the country.
Correct. And in fact, that's why a lot of these cases are not brought through private lawsuits. A lot of the parents, unfortunately, need the money. And without their children working in the fields, as far as farming is concerned, or working in these factories, they can't buy food, they can't afford rent. So it's a matter of survival. This is where the government has to come in and be paternalistic and say to the family, we can't allow you to just make your decision based on economic self-interest. We need to protect the children here so they're not susceptible to the same vicious cycle of poverty, which if they stay in the fields, if they stay in these factories, they're most likely to fall into. So there's no easy answer, but it really is the government, the state government and the federal government's responsibility to look out for these children, especially when their parents are otherwise not likely to do so.
Coming back to this 14 and 15-year-old case we have in Wisconsin, how about kids who are still in school and 16 or 17 years old? How do the laws change at that age?
So at 16 and 17, as you might gather, we give, that is Wisconsin gives and the federal government gives, a little bit more flexibility as far as how much they're allowed to work. So longer hours, including more than the 3 hours we talked about and the 18 hours per week. But also you can engage in more types of employment as far as occupations that are considered hazardous. So there is a distinction between 14 and 15-year-olds on the one hand, as far as employment and hours that they're prohibited from doing, and those who are a little bit older, 16 and 17, because at that point, the idea is they're more likely to have the responsibility and the know-how not to hurt themselves or hurt others in the workplace.
We'll leave it there and watch for future cases. Paul, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Okay, Rob. Great talking to you again. Take care.
You too. That's Paul Secunda. He's a labor and employment law professor at Marquette University. He was with us today to talk about child labor laws on the federal and state levels. This comes after the U.S. Department of Labor fined the franchise owner of 40 restaurants in Wisconsin and some out of Wisconsin for violations of child labor laws as they apply to teen workers aged 14 and 15. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert on civil and environmental engineering about what PFAS chemicals are. They've been in the news a lot lately, their history of use in consumer and other products, and why there are concerns now about their health risks and their factor in the environment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It was 10 years ago yesterday when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that limits on corporate campaign spending violated free speech. Coming up, we look at how the Citizens United decision has affected political campaigns and the ongoing efforts to overturn it. First, new regulations on firefighting foams with PFAS chemicals are headed to the governor's desk after they got approved in the assembly yesterday. And these PFAS chemicals have been in the news a lot lately. Trying to understand what they are, though, and their health risks can be tough. UW-Madison environmental engineering professor Christy Remicall recently broke down the basics in a piece for wiscontext.org. She talked to Central Time's executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson earlier today.
Let's start with the basics. What are PFAS?
So PFAS is a term that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. It's a group of over 5,000 or so synthetic chemicals. These chemicals have a lot of valuable properties, and they're used in a lot of different applications. So they can make surfaces non-stick or waterproof. So they're used in things like furniture, carpets, paper products, things that we use every day. They're also used in firefighting foams and many industrial applications as well.
We often hear PFAS called forever chemicals. What does that mean exactly?
So they're called forever chemicals because some chemicals that fall within this class do not have any known natural degradation processes that happen in the environment. So chemicals like PFOS or PFOA, scientists don't know yet if they break down at all in the environment. We estimate that they last a really long time.
Whereas some other chemicals might be broken down by, say, sunlight or some other things that they come in contact with in the environment.
Exactly. My group works on other kinds of chemicals like pesticides, and they can be broken down by microbes or sunlight. As you said, there are other processes, and these chemicals don't really degrade by those kinds of mechanisms.
You mentioned some of the ways that we see PFAS being used, for instance, in Teflon coatings, nonstick waterproofing. There's also the big area of firefighting materials. Tell us a little more about that.
Right. So PFAS have been used in firefighting foams mainly by the military and airports, but they're also used at sort of your regular fire station down the block. They help. They resist really high temperatures, and so they're really useful. They make firefighting foams more effective. And so we often find contamination of PFAS in sites, you know, near airports or military installations because of the use of these firefighting foams.
How long has this group of chemicals been used widely?
That's a really good question. PFAS have been in the news a lot lately, but they've actually been around a really long time. So some of them have been used since the 1940s and 50s.
And apparently for decades, they were used a lot. When did the risks first become known and points of concern?
Right. So they've been used a long time. I'd say scientists started measuring PFAS in the environment in the early 2000s. That's when people in the research community and other groups sort of started noticing that these chemicals were being found everywhere. And some of the concerns started coming out about them.
And what are some of those concerns? What are impacts? Let's start maybe with human health.
Right. So it's important to remember whenever we're talking about PFAS that we are talking about thousands of chemicals. Some of them have very well documented health effects, and some we really don't know very much about at all. So some that we know a lot about are things like PFOA and PFOS. These have been linked to a variety of health effects including things like thyroid disease, decreased fertility, pregnancy issues, immune response issues, and increased cholesterol. There's also some evidence of certain types of cancers, primarily among people who you had high exposure, so occupational settings.
I think I remember reading that virtually everyone in the United States has some PFAS in their bodies. Is that correct?
Yes, that is true. I mean, we're using these chemicals in many different applications, and they also build up in your body with time. I guess once they're in your body, it can take years for them to leave again. And so, yeah, that's sort of one thing we're worried about, is that the sort of constant exposure to them, they can build up with your body in time. And so, yep, pretty much everyone in the U.S. has some PFAS in them.
And how are we actually taking those chemicals into our bodies? I mean, I know that they're used in a variety of products, but what do we do that then makes them makes us susceptible to having them inside us?
Right. The main route of exposure to humans is ingestion. That could be, say, food contamination. So if you have like a microwavable popcorn bag that has PFAS in it, you could get it through your food. Drinking water that's contaminated with PFAS is a big concern. So if your water source has PFAS in it, that's a really important route of exposure. Or fish that live in contaminated environments can be another major route of exposure as well.
I certainly hear a lot with fish, especially or seafood, about mercury and other contaminants, but PFAS is one of those that we should be aware of as well.
It is. The DNR came out with some fish advisories, or they're coming out with it, related to PFAS contaminations measured in fish in Starkweather Creek, which is located in Madison. And so that's something I think we'll be seeing more of in the future.
We're talking right now with UW-Madison Environmental Engineering Professor Christy Remickel. She recently broke down the basics of PFAS chemicals in a piece for wiscontext.org. So we talked a little bit about the impact on human health, and we talked about the fact that it can be found in animals like fish. What about other environmental impacts?
All right. So this is something that we work on, is studying the fate of these chemicals in the environment and where they move around and where we need to look for them. These chemicals, because they can dissolve really well in water, they move around in the environment. And so one thing we're looking at, our work is focused up in the Marinette area, looking where these chemicals end up in surface waters, so rivers, Green Bay, Lake Michigan, and also the concentrations in sediment. So, yeah, there are lots of ways they can move around in the environment.
So that area around Marinette was a big focus because of the Tyco factory, mm-hmm. I believe, and the firefighting foam that contaminated water locally. For people in other parts of the state or even in other parts of the Midwest, how does that translate into a risk for their own water sources?
All right. So there's a lot we don't know. I mean, the DNR is doing a lot of testing and looking for contamination. I think we'll find more of these chemicals the more that we look for them. So I think it's just, yeah, people knowing that this could be a potential issue and sort of finding out what's in their own water as much as possible.
And water processing plants or filtration plants take care of a lot of things that can be harmful to human health, but this is not one of the things that gets screened out.
Exactly. So sort of traditional drinking water treatment processes are not designed to remove these chemicals. That being said, there are sort of commercial methods for removing PFAS from water. So things like activated carbon or reverse osmosis can remove PFAS from water. And these can be used either at the municipal scale or at the point of use, like at the home scale. So there are technologies available that do work for removing the chemicals.
Christy, in your research into PFAS, has there been anything that really surprised you that you found?
Our work is really just getting started. I'd say one of the biggest surprises in general in sort of my area of work is that the measurements that we make in the lab don't always match up with what's happening in the environment. And so to talk about PFAS specifically, and this is not my work, what others have seen is that if we look about how much these chemicals end up in the sediment, so the sort of sand and rocks at the bottom of a lake, we actually find a lot more there than you would predict based on laboratory measurements. And I've seen this with other chemicals as well. And I think this is really an important reason why we should get out of the lab and make measurements out in the field, because things happen in the environment that don't always match what happens in the lab.
And what are some of the challenges of studying these chemicals and then potential efforts to regulate them?
So one thing that's been really challenging and why this has sort of gotten a lot more attention recently is that these chemicals are hard to measure. We're talking about really low concentrations here. You have to use very precise methods. And these chemicals are so widely used that you have to be very careful with background contamination. So in the instrument that we use for measuring these chemicals, we had to switch out a bunch of parts that had PFAS in them in order to make our measurements. And so there's a lot that goes into doing the methods, and you have to be really careful with it. And that as scientists are just kind of able to do that really well in the past decade or so. So that's one thing that's a challenge, but also is why we're able to sort of make progress with it now.
And as we wrap up, are there places around Wisconsin that are trying to be more proactive in dealing with the potential health issues and environmental issues related to these chemicals?
Right. I mean, that's a really good question because, you know, there are regulations that are being sort of going through the rulemaking process in Wisconsin, but we don't have regulations on the books for these chemicals yet. And so there are some utilities, like the Madison Water Utility is a good example. They've been making measurements in all of their groundwater wells and reporting that data. And I think they're being really proactive about making the measurements and telling people what's there and kind of dealing with the results of that. But I think that's a really good thing. If you kind of have to find out if it's an issue, that's the first place to start.
Well, Christy, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Christy Remicall, an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UW-Madison. She talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about her PFAS explainer. You can find that at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at how political campaigning has changed since the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling 10 years ago. You can join in with your thoughts and questions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with a Wisconsin man who was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault when he was a teen. He was exonerated and became a lawyer, and today he was sworn into our state's Bar Association. First, a decade after the Citizens United ruling, the fight over campaign finance goes on. It happened 10 years ago yesterday. In a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court justices determined that limits on corporate campaign spending violated free speech. Democrats, including former President Obama, predicted big money would dominate U.S. elections. Here's a clip from his State of the Union address in 2010.
Last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
The decision also potentially benefited Democrats, as labor unions and others were able to ratchet up their spending. The group End Citizens United says $4.4 billion have been spent in federal elections since the ruling. But supporters of the decision say corporate voices have not drowned out those of ordinary people. They also say that it's allowed other important voices to be heard. Darrell West is vice president and director for governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author or co-author of 24 books, including Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era. Darrell, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Well, remind us what the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission ruling actually did.
Well, Citizens United was a conservative group that wanted to air a film critical of Hillary Clinton prior to one of the 2008 Democratic primaries. They were prohibited from doing that according to the dictates of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, also known as McCain-Feingold. They sued, said this was a violation of their freedom of speech. And as you noted, the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote said that it was unlawful to limit their independent expenditures. And since then, we have seen the floodgate of big money open up, and you know, money has become a corrupting influence in American elections.
American elections have always seen a lot of money. Did this bring new money into elections, or did it just funnel money that might have been spent in another way on American politics in a different direction?
Well, people have to remember that after the Watergate scandal of the 1970s, we passed a bipartisan campaign finance reform in 1976 that really placed a lot of restrictions on campaign finance. What has happened in the time since then is, bit by bit, new loopholes have been opened up, new exceptions have been created, there were a series of court decisions, and the result today is we have a wild west of campaign finance. There are virtually no restrictions on big money coming into politics. People used to have to disclose their campaign expenditures. They had to file very detailed reports with the Federal Elections Commission. We have very little transparency. There's a lot of secret money that's undisclosed that comes into the process, and that's very destructive of any Democratic election.
The argument in favor of that kind of spending is, hey, if I want to participate in politics, spending money might be part of that. Political advertising, political advocacy is part of my free speech rights, whether I'm spending $10 or $10 million.
Yeah, the advocates did make that free speech argument, and that was ratified by the Supreme Court. But what it essentially did was basically empower big money and secret money to come into the process. Like, I don't think anybody objects to anybody expressing their view about an election or being pro or a con on particular politicians. But what Citizens United did, previously there were restrictions on the ability of corporations and labor unions to spend independently to influence the election. The Citizens United case removed those restrictions. And so it allowed corporate money to become a much bigger part of our election process. And now, a decade later, we see, you know, it's a big part of the Democratic debate, the role of corporations and, you know, whether the Democratic Party has been captured by corporate interests.
How have we seen that kind of corporate money get spent on politics since Citizens United?
I mean, right now, corporations are free to spend independently in favor of or against any politician. So prior to Citizens United, there were restrictions on their ability to do that. So you now have lots of companies developed political action committees. They spend hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars trying to influence the election. And so the costs of elections have gone up. And then this case, combined with other cases, has removed the transparency. I mean, it's one thing if people are spending a lot of money and we know who is spending that money. But of course, today there's a lot of secrecy in the process. There's a lot of dark money in the process. So there's large money being spent. And in many cases, we don't even know who is spending the money.
As you mentioned, labor unions were included in this. Is that a balanced playing field then? Corporations can spend lots of money, but hey, unions can too, so it all balances out?
There's not really a balance in reality just because corporations have access to so much more money than do labor unions. We know that over the last several decades, the percentage of Americans belonging to unions have dropped substantially. Unions are much weaker than they were certainly 10 years ago and 20 and 30 years ago. And so even though technically this ruling benefited both corporations and labor unions, corporations are the ones with the money, and therefore were able to take advantage of this exemption that opened up.
Talking to Daryl West from the Brookings Institution, looking at the anniversary 10 years yesterday of the Citizens United ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, how it's affected campaign spending. A lot of people, when they talk about Citizens United, also mention another ruling a few years later, the McCutcheon ruling, which also freed up more money. What is that and how does that fit into the story?
Yeah, these two decisions taken together were really the major court decisions that basically blew up the previous campaign finance rule. So this Citizens United dealt with independent expenditures. The later case dealt with issue advocacy and transparency in politics. So when you take them together, that explains why we now have elections that are awash in big money, awash in secret money. I mean, these are the cases that really blew it up. And the justices really used this freedom of speech argument to justify. They argued that the freedom to spend is the same as the freedom of speech, kind of not recognizing that billionaires have a lot more speech rights than an ordinary working class person just because of their access to substantial resources.
Now, Bradley Smith was a former head of the Federal Elections Commission, a longtime opponent of campaign finance regulations. He wrote an opinion piece in The Wall Street Journal this week, timed to this anniversary. He said, among other things, most spending still comes from individuals who give directly to candidates. He said that corporations contribute well under 10% of federal political spending, so that the floodgates, he says, haven't been as bad as people predicted at the time. What do you think of that?
I think he is ignoring all the dark money that has come into the process. The problem is there's so much money that's unaccountable, that is not transparent, that we don't know who is behind that giving. And so he may look at the disclosed money and argue that individuals still contribute the bulk of it, but there's all this dark money where we don't even know where it is coming from. And, you know, today people worry about the influence of foreign individuals and foreign countries and their ability to influence our process. With all the dark money around, like, we don't even know where that money is coming from.
Can you connect the dots now between the campaign contributions and the dark money and all the rest of it and actual policy decisions? Does this actually sway the laws that get passed and enforced in this country?
Well, politics has definitely tilted in favor of corporations. You can certainly see it in terms of tax policy over a period of years. The effective tax rate for corporations has dropped into the single digits. Some companies aren't paying any taxes. Others are paying 2 to 3%. You can kind of look in terms of social welfare policy and how business interests have been well represented and well defended in public policy. But the interests of working class people have not been addressed nearly to the same extent. So we can argue that there's a very direct tie between the campaign finance changes that we've seen that unleashed a lot of corporate money and public policy changes that then corresponded to that.
Daryl West is with us from the Brookings Institution talking about how the Citizens United ruling has affected political campaigns. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down that decision 10 years ago yesterday. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the ruling has been good or bad for American politics? Do you see big money corrupting political campaigns? Do you think that campaign spending should be regarded as free speech? Are you less likely to support a candidate who accepts money from PACs if you are aware that they do that? What kind of changes, if any, do you think we need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about how the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling from a decade ago is affecting political campaigns today. Daryl West is with us, Vice President and Director for Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's author or co-author of 24 books, including Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Citizens United ruling on campaign finance in the United States, what changes you think might be needed, if any, your thoughts on spending money in politics and how it fits into free speech in the country. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Pat is with us in Wauwatosa. Pat, hi.
Hi. I think we could get rid of Citizens United very quickly if we were willing to practice civil disobedience to force the hand of Congress. And the way to do that, and time is of the essence, would be to threaten to boycott the U.S. Census, which would put every congressional district at risk, and congressmen don't want to lose their their political district. But it would take a concerted effort of people to say, until you pass legislation that eliminates the excessive money in politics or it eliminates gerrymandered seats, we're not going to participate in the census, and therefore your district is going to be expanded into non-political units.
Pat, thanks for the call. Whether it's that kind of civil disobedience or not, Daryl, a lot of people unhappy about Citizens United, but do you see campaign finance as a key motivating issue that will really get people taking action on it?
I mean, it should motivate people in the sense that the corrosive power of big corporate money in American elections is part of the reason why working class people are not doing well today. I mean, there have been a number of studies kind of looking at average wages from 1980 up through the current period, and average people adjusted for inflation basically have gotten either no or very little increase in their wages over time. And just to address one thing Pat said, we don't want to boycott the census. That's not going to take away any congressional seats. If anything, we need a really accurate count so that House races actually represent all of America as opposed to just those Americans who are counted in the census.
Thanks for that call. Go to Rick now in Holman. Rick, hello.
Well, hello, sir.
What did you want to bring up, Rick?
Well, I got a comment on that. I think since the very beginning of the United States, money has ruled everything. Always has. You look at our founders, they were the richest people in America. And it's always been that way. Teddy Roosevelt, all the Roosevelts, all the Kennedys, all the Bushes. This is just the money's unlimited. And their donors are unlimited. And we're not going to change that.
Rick, thanks for the call. So, Daryl, we can pass all the laws we want. Money's going to find a way.
I mean, Rick is certainly right that money always has been important. But I do want to point out that in the post-Watergate period from roughly 1976 through the mid-90s, we actually had a really good campaign finance system in the sense that it was a balanced system. It was a transparent system. People could spend money, but they had to disclose that they were spending the money. So people could evaluate what was going on in elections because we knew a lot more about where the money was coming from. It's really just been in the last 20 years that we've reverted to an era of large money and secret money, but it doesn't have to be that way, and it actually wasn't that way for the 20 years after Watergate.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Nancy joins us now in Ellsworth. Nancy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for the program. Yes, Citizens United needs to be overturned. I have seen, as a practicing attorney in Wisconsin, where gerrymandering is also a terrible problem, that the money, the big money in government, it essentially steps on the necks and the throats of the underclasses. It doesn't allow people to have their own voice. The vote has become a sham, but we have hope. We have an impeached president today. And so finally, people are stepping up and saying we deserve our rights and we won't stand for so much corruption, such obvious corruption in our government. Thank you.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Daryl, do you think it's fair to call it corruption? Sometimes people think of corruption as if I'm the politician, I'm getting some kind of personal benefit, not money spent on behalf of my campaign.
I mean, money is corrupting for the system as a whole just in the sense that big money then encourages politicians to overrepresent certain interests and underrepresent other interests. And we've basically been in this era of the corporatization of American politics for several decades now, and we can see how it has skewed public policy. And in the 2020 election, now there's more attention being paid to this in terms of the role of corporations, the fairness of our tax policy, the nature of the social policies that we are adopting. There are lots of new proposals that are on the table there. So I think it is fair to say that there has been corruption that has come out of our system of campaign finance because it's tilted public policy in a way that disadvantages the average American.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. We're talking to Darrell West from the Brookings Institution about the Citizens United decision 10 years ago yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court and how it affected campaign finance, campaign spending, and American politics. Back to your calls now. Krishnan is with us in Racine. Krishnan, hi.
Hi. So my question is, why couldn't we change the system to say only people can contribute money and not groups or organizations? Because only people get to vote. Organizations don't. So that way you would be potentially limiting the amount of money that's coming in, but also preserving free speech.
Krishnan, thanks for the call. What do you think, Darrell?
I mean, that was the issue that was decided in Citizens United. I mean, previously there were very significant restrictions on the ability of corporations and unions to spend money. As a result of Citizens United, those restrictions were removed. And so that's what allowed the dramatic increase in corporate money coming into the process and, to a lesser extent, the amount of labor union money that came into the process. So in order to change that, either there has to be a change in the Supreme Court such that that 5-4 decision moves in the other direction, or some people have suggested that the justices are so wedded to this freedom to spend is equivalent to freedom of speech, that it actually might take a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United.
Thanks for that call. Do you see, Darrell, a room for something that could pass in Congress to restrict campaign spending that might pass muster even with the current Supreme Court makeup?
Well, after Watergate, there were several reform pieces of campaign finance that were enacted into law and governed American elections. It's just that, you know, in the last 20 years, bit by bit, we've opened up a bunch of different loopholes in the system and now reached a point where there are virtually no meaningful restrictions in terms of campaign finance. So we certainly could go back to a model where Congress is passing tougher laws, but the problem is really the Supreme Court makes it very difficult for Congress to impose restrictions on campaign finance just because they view the power to spend as equivalent to freedom of speech, and they don't want to impose any restrictions on the freedom of speech.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us now in Wausau. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's possible to adjust or do something with the Citizens United that says that it limits it to privately held companies rather than publicly held. In other words, rule out publicly held companies from being able to donate, if that makes sense.
Gotcha, Mike. That sounds like an even taller order in some ways, Darrell.
Yeah, courts would not be very likely, at least under the current composition of the court, to support that type of measure. But there are shareholders who are starting to object to the way corporations are spending campaign finance money, and you know, they're showing up at annual meetings and trying to have votes that either limit or redirect the way the corporation is spending the money. So that's not a legal change, but it's an effort through the power of people to try and change the way that corporations are handling their money.
Thanks for that call. Darrell, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for when it comes to the cash flow in election 2020?
Well, the one bit of optimism that we've seen in some past elections, and we're also seeing it in 2020, is the power of the small donor. Like, if the courts make it very difficult to impose restrictions on large donors, the way to counterbalance that is if small donors basically band together, and even if they're just giving $10, $15, and $20 at a time, there are candidates that actually are raising a lot of money from individuals. And so anything we can do to encourage people to give money, like there are mobile texting systems that allow people to donate directly to candidates that well, anything that empowers small donors is a way to counterbalance the current power of the large donors.
Darrell, we'll watch for that this year. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Darrell West is Vice President and Director for Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author or co-author of a bunch of books, including Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. We talked to him about the 10th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that found that restrictions on corporate spending in politics are violations of free speech. You can keep the conversation going. Let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And speaking of politics, we'll be running the State of the State address from Governor Evers here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can catch that tonight starting at 7, anchored by Sean Johnson of WPR, Frederica Freiberg of Wisconsin Public Television, and then join us on the Ideas Network for more on that tomorrow. There's a lot of serious stuff going on in the U.S. Senate impeachment process, but there's also been some interesting news about snacks and beverages on the Senate floor. If you're wondering what they eat and drink and other Senate facts, here they are. As I mentioned on the show yesterday, the only approved beverages during the impeachment process are water and apparently milk. The milk thing is kind of from an obscure past precedent. It seems complicated. I don't quite get it. But that this has some coffee-drinking senators looking forward to their breaks to get their caffeine re-up. And some people have speculated that dairy state senators may have helped write these rules to help get milk on the list. That's beverages. How about food? The rule is no food, except candy from the Senate candy desk. Yes, there is a Senate candy desk. As reported in the New York Times, the tradition goes back to 1965. A California Republican named George Murphy had a sweet tooth and kept his desk well stocked with candy to share among the members of the Senate. If I get this right now, whichever senator gets assigned to the desk has the job of the candy senator. Now, Pennsylvania Republican Patrick Toomey has that desk today. His office keeps it well stocked with snack-sized candy bars from his home state, easy to do with Hershey and related brands. And so now, if you're a senator, you need something, some sustenance, you've got snack-sized Hershey bars, I guess. I don't know if that's the best thing to fuel an intense Senate debate. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.